This is the People's Game for Wednesday, June 30th, 2010, the 20th day of the World Cup tournament. I'm Alan Minsky.
And I'm Jennifer Doyle. And on today's show, we have Supriya Nair, who is the writer behind Treason, Stratagems, and Spoils, a fantastic blog which she writes from Mumbai, India. And she will be talking to us about writing about the World Cup from India and also about her favorite side, Brazil. And she'll be giving us her read on both the strategies on the field and the critical context through which we have been understanding the World Cup.
And she'll also let us know just how closely this tournament is followed in one of the two most populous countries in the world. India is a far away from qualifying for the World Cup on the field, but it's followed passionately across the country.
And we'll be speaking with the girls of Global Girl Media. We'll be speaking with young women in Soweto, South Africa, who have been reporting on the stories that matter most to them as members of the direct community impacted by the presence of the World Cup. And they will review some of the stories they've written about and produced about cell phone technology, the use of sports in empowering local communities, as well as the hard-hitting subject of sexual identity, homophobic assault, and its impact on them as young women in South Africa.
So stay tuned for The People's Game. This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky.
I'm Jennifer Doyle. And we're here today, I'm very excited, with Supriya Nair. Supriya Nair is one of my absolute favorite bloggers in the footballing universe. You can follow her writing at Treason, Stratagem, and Spoils. If you just look for that phrase, it's inevitable that you will find her. I want to recommend to listeners to follow her Twitter feed, which you can do through her blog. Her tweeting on the games is absolutely outstanding. So with that, I want to welcome Supriya to the People's Game. And
Hello, Jennifer.
Hi.
And thank you for that lovely introduction.
On your blog this morning, and I wanted to ask you to speak a little bit, just sort of to introduce listeners to you, about your work blogging about the World Cup from Mumbai, India.
This is something that my blog specifically is a sports blog, largely about football, but also a little bit about cricket, which, as you know, is big in India. And anything that happens in the sporting universe that happens to catch my eye. I have to warn listeners that I'm a pretty sporadic blogger, and until the World Cup began, I didn't actually take it much in earnest because, you know, real life intrudes, etc. But what interests me most about sport, about football, and about the World Cup in particular are the politics associated with the game, both on the field and off.
Yes.
So what I love best about it are its tactics, and I think there are a lot of issues around this extremely unique World Cup, which FIFA has been touting as the African World Cup, that interest me and that often pain me. So I use my blog to talk about a lot of that.
Yes.
I also use it to celebrate the teams I love and excoriate them.
In India, so where are people watch? Are there public screenings of matches? Is there a lot of public discourse about the World Cup? Or is this something that, like in the United States, you feel like you're part of an underground button following it?
Well, there is a tremendous amount of discourse if you were simply to go with the front pages of newspapers day after day.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that it wasn't always like this. If you can stand a little bit of history, I think for us, for the longest time, not being a footballing power, the World Cup was one time that the entire country plugged into football through what I think maybe about two decades ago were extremely limited means. So, you know, we were part of the world that that followed Pele's World Cups on the radio. We were part of the world that was introduced to color television with Maradona's World Cup in 86. So in that sense, when people talk about those waves of history, you know, for the game globally, I think we were pretty much part of that. Our foray into cable television and sort of networks and all of that began two decades ago. And since then, the game has pretty much followed this standard pattern that I think, you know, you correct me if I'm wrong, that it's also sort of followed in the States,
yeah,
where through cable network broadcasting of, say, the English Premier League and other European leagues, It's acquired a steady following for the domestic football of other countries. And so we've worked up to this point in 2010 where you have one part of what FIFA would again call the market, which is extremely football ready. So mm-hmm. we're sort of ready to buy into the product. Mm-hmm. And we watch football as pretty much anyone else in the world would. We watch it in bars, in restaurants. Not so much in public squares because, you know, I mean, at least in Bombay, it's a crowded city and people would be very upset if we disrupted traffic to do that. And we follow it on television. We have World Cup parties. We follow it on the internet.
Yeah, one of the things I noticed when I was in when I was in India in December that caught my eye was that images of the premiership were used to sell televisions and big billboards in Mumbai, and it struck me that that is a sign of exactly the kind of football-ready market, and it's the ways in which that's also bound to technology and to cable television and the selling of these products. And I thought, you know, because there were images of cricket players and around the same kind of marketing strategy, but that's actually not something that you see quite so often, although you're now starting to see that just, I think, around this World Cup again in the United States, where the image of football is used to sell the product, setting aside the Spanish language market, where that has actually long been true here. Do you follow I-League stuff at all, India's professional league?
No, I'm afraid not, except for when it generates controversy.
Mm.
There's actually fairly little opportunity for us to follow it in a sustained way. Mm. The matches do show sporadically on television, but I'm not sure if you're aware of sort of, you know, the problems associated with viewership, with stadium numbers and so on
yeah.
and so forth. In fact, we just had one of our biggest clubs, one of our most high-profile clubs, Mahindra United, shut down. It was a club that was very much a part of the I-League, and it was sponsored by one of our biggest corporations. And they just decided to shut it down because it just wasn't generating enough interest or revenue. Of course, the corporation does say that they're now going to channel their efforts into grassroots football, which is something everyone agrees that the country needs.
Yeah.
But with your earlier question,
yes.
Jennifer, about the viewership of the World Cup and about football in general, I think there's just one part that can readily be defined as the market, which is huge, which is, you know, sort of the bonbon-eating English newspaper reading class. But I also feel like the World Cup is one event where you will still have that part of the population that grew up with the World Cup on the radio, on black and white television, and on, you know, eventually on color television. You will find them tuning in too. So I think in one sense, this really does unite a lot of India with the world, and not mm. just people like me who are sitting in an urban center. So, that just sort of tied in with the whole idea of grassroots football and people in non-urban centers relating yeah. to the game.
Well, one of the things, again, that is always talked about in the United States about the World Cup, and one of the ways in which it is marketed in the United States, is this is an event more than any other event that ties the whole world together. And obviously, India has been a conspicuous absence from the World Cup tournament, as has mainland China. So is the World Cup the singular most popular television spectacle in India in 2010, as it is in pretty much most of the world, except for maybe China, India, and the United States?
Well, the figures aren't officially in yet, but I do hear that it's been generating unprecedented amounts of interest. But we are an extremely wealthy and captive market for cricket. And I'm not sure if you know, but we recently concluded our domestic league tournament, which is sort of this gunslinging round-robin 45-day cricket tournament that usually, typically generates huge numbers. So I'm not sure how that compares with that.
Mm.
But I would say definitely that this World Cup has probably generated more viewership than any other World Cup in India's history,
yeah.
simply because, you know, the medium is reaching so many more people.
So I want to get to the World Cup and matches mm-hmm. and your writing. I just want to signal to listeners. I woke up this morning and I checked my Twitter feed first thing now when I wake up. And I woke up to the following lines from Supriya. sobbing relief of coming home and only having real life to worry about, because this is our first day off since the World Cup began. And I'm sorry to interrupt this by actually dragging you back into this world. So I want to actually maybe you wrote a wonderful piece about Brazil and the way that Brazil's been playing. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you see Brazil doing from here on out. I have a ton of questions that I can ask you, because I know that you can talk actually quite intelligently about a wide range of teams. But let's just start with Brazil.
I'm so wary of predictions. As you know, Brazil were, in fact, I mean, contrary to the fact that they fell short of their fans' expectations, they were actually one of the better sides in the World Cup in 2006, I thought, until they had that bizarre match against France in which they sort of just fell apart. And I'm holding my breath and hoping that that's not going to happen again. Of course, all evidence points to the fact that it won't, because as you've seen, we've seen an extraordinary cohesion between Brazil's lines of play, you know, their defense connecting with their midfield, thanks to the largely unsung, I think, Gilberto Silva and Felipe Melo when he's around. With a team that links up so strongly, you know, across across the field, it would be heartbreaking to think that they could, in fact, collapse. But who knows, right?
Well, one of the things that I liked about your observations about Brazil is they've been under a bit of criticism for the Europeanization of the Brazilian game. And you you actually offer a beautiful, a strong argument for that Europeanization of the Brazilian game. So what is it that people have been complaining about, and why do you argue against those complaints?
I don't think we can actually argue against the Europeanization, because for better or for worse, we do associate this kind of organization with European teams. But I do think it's unfair of people to argue that that Brazil are a defensive side, when in fact I think the reverse is true. I don't think that a side that necessarily defends well is one that only defends well.
Yeah.
Brazil are proof of that. You know, typically they've had, I mean, their wingbacks have been celebrated for being the sort to, like, sort of bomb forward unrepentantly. Well, this Brazil has an entire back line that actually does that.
Yeah.
And somehow they're still, because they're so quick, you know, they're still able to recover possession brilliantly. They're able to go on the break fantastically. So I don't think they're actually untrue to the principles of beautiful football or attacking football. I do think that what they lack is perhaps that, you know, those marquee names, possibly because players like Robinho, who are more than capable of offering, you know, entertainment as a side to the as a sideshow to the main game, have sort of been, I don't know, reined in,
yeah,
if that's the right word. But I love the way he's been linking up with Kaká. I think that's something to celebrate. So perhaps they're atypical, but I certainly don't think that they're ugly. I certainly don't think,
yeah,
they deserve to be called purely defensive.
Yeah.
And I do think that a completely self-aware football of the sort that they're playing is as beautiful as anything past generations might have seen.
I'm completely with you on this. I think there's an ease with which people turn the... somebody called it the dark arts of defending. I feel like one of the people calling the matches, maybe for ESPN. People take the defensive side of the game and see it as to quote Zizek, they're thieves of enjoyment. You know, it's the force which robs the viewer of all pleasure. And the first line of any good attack is the defense. And also the first line of any good defense are the attackers. Breaking up the attempt to get plays started at the top. I mean, so I think that we've been seeing actually, the stronger sides actually doing that kind of work on both ends. I actually thought we saw a lot of that in the Spain-Portugal match yesterday. So, but I also
that game. Did you enjoy it? Was it a typical game of flary, fancy football?
I had almost nothing to say about it because I enjoyed watching it so much. I haven't yet been able to get my critical edge and sort of, you know, teeth into it. Alan, how would you say that?
Well,
match
I'm the devil's advocate in this conversation. I actually posted on the People's Game early on in the tournament an article about the 1982 match between Italy and Brazil, the Brazilian side in 1982 being one of the most celebrated teams in the history of the World Cup for their beauty. And they kept pushing forward against an Italian side that kept going ahead. 1-0, then Brazil would tie. 2-1, then Brazil would tie. And finally, Italy won. In the match, Brazil only needed a tie, but they sort of couldn't contain their sort of will to go forward. This was a team with Socrates and Zico. And the Italians, of course, sitting back in their famous defensive shell, which then they lure people in and then counterattack. Italy won and defeated this most celebrated of Brazilian sides. And I believe that the evolution of the Brazilian national team has now come to this side with Dunga, which has internalized the lessons of that traumatic match where this most beloved Brazilian teams has been lost. And now Brazil is very attentive to winning. And I actually have to sort of disagree, which is that they're a marvelous side to watch. They're fantastic. But part of the joy that people look to Brazil for is, I think, absent from this team. And it's not that that's a bad thing. This is still a beautiful side, and they should definitely be appreciated. But they're very direct, and it's those flourishes. It's the sort of samba nature of certain moves that people turn to Brazil and look for. That's the source of joy, and I don't think that that can be, you know, basically denied or not recognized as an absence. And your thoughts on that, Supriya?
I think maybe that one of the things that that affect people is that there isn't actually a player who can successfully sort of break free of a game's rhythm in Brazil this time around. I mean, you have someone like Kaká who I love. I've watched him at Milan, which is my favorite team, and I think his creative intelligence is uncanny. And it's a source of some grief to me, actually, that he's been kind of sluggish for most of this tournament. But he's not the sort of player. I mean, he's not a Ronaldo. You know, when Ronaldo played, transcendence was. You could expect transcendence. Kaká is very much someone who judges the game as a whole, and part of the pleasure of watching him is very different from the pleasure of watching a Ronaldo. So maybe that's not. Maybe that's something that's specific to this team rather than specific to a mindset. I'm not sure that we can say 100% that this is a template for the Brazilian football of the future.
Maybe we could bring this around to the another piece of writing of yours recently, which is responding to John Barnes's the retired British footballer, his statement, "Football is a socialist sport," and his critique of England for not actually fully understanding the spirit of the collective spirit required by a great footballing side. There's been a bit of lamenting of the absence of the celebrity icon footballers within this tournament. Those who came into the tournament with that kind of stature, basically, there seems to have been no relationship to, for example, their status as an advertising figure and their performance on the field, which has actually not been true in World Cups of the past. And right now what we have are these teams which seem to have a kind of real collective spirit. Perhaps there is less of that kind of pleasure that, Alan, that you're talking about in such a side. Supriya, what's your kind of take on that?
No, I read the Barnes piece, and I think specifically to address this this ridiculous idea once and for all that a player's ego or that their performance should be judged based on how much they're making from endorsements is a form of reverse classism that tabloids are guilty of practicing, and I think we really shouldn't be spending much time on that. Mm. As far as marquee names are concerned, I do think that the presence of a couple of, say, Spain superstars or the little man in Argentina. Well, I am of course talking about Messi. I realize that can be sort of interpreted in a number of ways. I don't think there's a complete absence. I think one of the reasons I sort of one of the things that threw me out of Barnes's opinion was, of course, this sort of very superficial understanding of socialism and capitalism, which I don't think applies to football or to footballing nations anymore. Mm. I do think that he was right when he was talking about the collective mattering more than the individual, but in this World Cup, what we're seeing that as manifested as a good organization. I think maybe teams like Germany, which I think have pleasantly surprised everyone, not just with their their effectiveness, as people like to pigeonhole, their best quality, but simply because within their organization they are able to play beautifully and effectively, And I think it's the breakdown of that spirit, of that collective mindset that affected England. I say breakdown, but arguably they never actually had any in the first place.
Yeah, I think that's actually an important thing for listeners to understand. It's not like England fell apart. I mean, it's that they came in very wobbly and weak from the start.
Right. And I think, again, you know, maybe we can also break down the collective mindset a bit more and talk about how the presence of link-up players is actually a good, you know, a hallmark of the good sides of this tournament. We spoke about Gilberto and Melo in Brazil, and I think the German team has sort of been great as well, you know, with their box-to-box midfielders sort of really effectively connecting the team across the pitch. So maybe it's down to just having sort of the right men in midfield. Italy, for example, suffered greatly because they had a number of talented players, none of whom seemed prepared to take up the role that Andrea Pirlo played in 2006. And I think that I think more than sort of their defensive mistakes or their general lack of enthusiasm, I think this is essentially what affected them the most.
Yeah, in fact, Uruguay is doing a marvelous job that using Forlan in a number of different roles, but including as a link-up player, because generally their midfield players are like Gattuso's, and they're attackers on the ball. They don't have a lot of creativity linking up with the forwards, and they're throwing Forlan back there some of the time. Sometimes they throw him forward, and it's a big part of their cohesion. Actually, I was going to ask you to, if you don't mind, go a little bit more into detail about what you said about capitalism and socialism off of Barnes's article. I just would love to hear you maybe riff off of the top of your head about that, because I just love to hear the perspective from the point of view of somebody in Mumbai thinking about the ways that socialism, capitalism, and these metaphors do or do not relate to the contemporary game.
All right, let me try and express myself as clearly as I can. I do think that this is sort of a straight up a falsification of the truths of the world as it is right now and of the footballing nations who are still in the World Cup. Going by what John Barnes said, if England displayed a capitalist mentality and went out, I mean, is one then to assume that it is England's capitalism as a whole that has failed it as a footballing nation? I'm not necessarily sure that's true. Germany is still in the game, and they're, I know social democracy is sort of Europe's modus operandi right now, but for the purposes of this discussion, you know, it's not like they're a committed socialist nation. South American nations like Brazil and Argentina are not exactly what you would call beacons of socialism in the world as it is right now. And if it was in fact purely a question of team spirit, you know, triumphing over everything, of the socialist mindset triumphing over everything, then a team like Japan, which was knocked out last night, but which I thought were extremely impressive through the group stages, simply for the remarkable way in which the team melded together, pulled their relatively limited resources, you know, compared to bigger opponents, and fought back and did beautifully. So I think that breaking it down into political metaphors was probably a bad idea. We've already seen, this tournament associated with a lot of that, and I do think we should try and resist these sort of simplifications as much as possible, simply because they're just such a trap and they're so easy for us to fall into.
Yeah, and it's also, they kind of, there's a way in which it invites you to kind of romanticize certain sides within the World Cup, or using a rhetoric around an anti-capitalist rhetoric. But, you know, push comes to shove, if we're going to actually sort of think right against capitalism through something like football, the teams that we should be celebrating and loving wouldn't be really in the World Cup. You know, that the whole logic, right, of triumphing over everything, of participating in this particular kind of media spectacle, there's no element of this to me that actually resonates with like a kind of real cellular sort of anti-capitalist sentiment. I'm suspicious of the marshalling, right, of a political righteousness, right, in the service of, in essence, a brand identity of a team.
But I do think that what is true, though, is that we can see in certain sides the way that teams work and the ways that space are created for individual creativity in the service of the welfare of the team, not to say that's either capitalist or socialist, but then to recognize that this is a good model for human interaction. You know, I think that can be said. I mean, I've been reading this marvelous book on Dutch football and the way total football was developed. And it created all this space for, you know, creativity and incredible amounts of team cohesion. And, you know, if only it were possible to have a society that functioned in such a manner.
So, Supriya, what matches are you really looking forward to that are coming up this week?
I'm having been through, I think, a fantastic knockout stage. I can't really say there's any one that I'm not looking forward to. I am, in fact, terrified for Paraguay in Spain. But everything else is fair game. Bring it on. I hope Holland-Brazil is going to live up to expectations. I fear that we may already have attached too much importance or sentiment to it.
And so is Brazil your side through the whole tournament already, or is there another team that you're rooting for also? Or?
Well, after Italy went out, I was tremendously impressed by Japan, so I was rooting for them, and I was bitterly disappointed at their loss last night, although I think, you know, they played with an uncharacteristic amount of fear, which is probably what did them in.
Yeah.
So from now on, I think I'm going to be a neutral if there is, in fact, any such thing once the whistle goes. But I would love to see Argentina do well, to be honest. Argentina is traditionally one of the sides that has had a huge following in India, maybe second only to Brazil.
And why do you feel that way about Argentina, wishing them well?
Well, part of it is traditional. I grew up around men who enjoyed and supported Argentina. So there's an element of that. I also think that, you know, since we haven't seen them win in a while, it would just be nice to spread the love around a little bit. But otherwise, no particular reason, to be honest. I definitely would want to resist the idea that that Argentina is a team made up of spectacular individuals, which is why we should support them. They are, of course, but it's just the wish for something different.
And why are you an? I've discerned that you're an Italian partisan. Why are you a fan of the Azzurri?
Well, it goes back to '98, which is the tournament I first clearly remember following, and there was just something I think about them being. There was a vaguely underdogish element to them, and they played with such grit. I remember, I think, the quarterfinal against France, in which someone smashed a then extremely young Fabio Cannavaro's cheekbone in, and you know he just got it bound up and trotted out to play again. So '98 was a tournament in which Italy sort of made a huge emotional impact. It was also the year Croatia came up with a great performance, if you remember.
Yeah.
So they're also a team I've loved, and I was sorry not to see them at this World Cup.
I have a question as one sort of unlikely blogger to another. Mm-hmm. What drew you to blogging about sports? And could you speak a little bit as a woman who's also an intellectual and a writer about entering into this sort of domain and what that has been like for you?
I think what I've been extremely fortunate to experience online is a community of football watching female fans. Some of whom have been great and extremely public. Some of whom, you know, I interact with in sort of private communities and mailing lists. But there are other bloggers who either sort of paved the way or you know sort of took up the standard at the same time. If you remember, if you were reading The Offside, I think around 2006, you probably read Martha's work. She is a stellar blogger, and she is on Twitter as Martha Calcio. And she follows, and her take on world football is always refreshing and always learned. And to see someone like that was actually fantastically inspiring.
Yeah.
And you know, there are still women from sort of all over the world, including you, Jennifer, and you know, bloggers in Malaysia, in New Zealand, and places like that. So I've never actually, what I was lucky not to experience the football blogosphere as an exclusively male-centric domain.
Yeah.
At first.
I've found that it's only the most commercial, the most commercial and most mainstream fan communities that, you know, where it's not that they're all male, but it's that I'd say they're kind of anti-feminist. But for the most part, I'd actually say that's a minor experience for me in terms of blogging and my interactions with other bloggers. And I'm really glad that you mentioned The Offside is the offside.com.
Right. and it has a bunch of sub-blogs, and a lot of them are written by excellent women bloggers.
Yeah, and I mean, there used to be a blogger there, Laurie of Les Bleus. I don't think she's still writing for them, but they have some other people reporting on the French leagues. Mm-hmm. I think she's the most authoritative English language voice on the French football in all of its dimensions. And, you know, she's a woman who lives in the northwest of the United States and just has a passion for the game. And I find that such women to me have inspired me and also give me a sense of community. Your writing too, I consider these writers as well as the men who also participate in this community, kind of a progressive and very kind of flexible political community of sports fans, to be my ideal readers. I feel like I write for you guys, and I feel like you guys are writing for me. So,
absolutely.
Supriya Nair's blog is Treason, Stratagem, and Spoils, and she is speaking with us from Mumbai about the World Cup. And I want to thank you for participating in this conversation. Alan, do you have any more questions?
I have one more question, which is, I think, one thing that is distinctive about the way that the World Cup has moved into the United States versus the way it is received in India. Is the fact that the U.S. men's team, of course, participated in the tournament. And I'm just wondering what you can tell our listeners about where the Indian national men's team is right now in terms of their development, and if you believe they have any chance of qualifying in 2014.
Their rank at the moment, I believe, is 132. We're somewhere in the ballpark of sort of, you know, the same sort of footballing prowess as Fiji. I actually think Fiji may have a better men's team than ours. I would be overly optimistic to say that they had much chance of qualifying for 2014. Just to put it into perspective, we went out in the first round of the Asian qualifying.
Right.
We were beaten by Lebanon. And in spite of the fact that football is sort of gaining interest and that we've always had iconic footballers in this country, I do think we're a long way from it being a grassroots revolution, at least in men's football and in men's professional football. So I'm not holding my breath for 2014, but maybe in a generation or so we can look back and see.
It's heartbreaking because I had the very good luck to spend a little time with the men's national team in December.
Oh,
and,
did you?
Yeah, and there's a lot, you know, they're just like any guys who are playing on their national team. They're so excited to represent India. They want to do nothing but play football. They're very athletic and not without talent. And that fact was actually, you know, demonstrated by Subrata Paul had a tryout with the Vancouver Whitecaps and MLS side. Mm-hmm. You know, and he got, you know, according to the team press material around this, they really liked him and they thought he had the ability to play at the top level, but that he just needs more exposure. To, you know, top level international competition in order to become, you know, just move up to the next level. And I think that's true for a lot of the Indian players is that they're isolated by virtue
that's
of the,
absolutely true.
Yeah, and it's,
I think one of our forwards is now playing in the MLS, Sunil Chhetri.
Yes, Sunil Chhetri for the Kansas City Wizards.
That's right.
Yeah, and I'm not sure he's taken the field yet because he's just sort of, he's just joined the roster this season. But
right, and I read him saying that you know he definitely did think that things like fitness were key issues, you know, which he was sort of discovering about himself while he was warming up and practicing with the rest of the team. So I think maybe infrastructurally we need to get a lot going. We need to offer our footballers a lot more.
Yeah.
Administratively to ensure that they're paid fairly and so on and so forth. As you know, Baichung Bhutia, who is sort of by far our most famous footballer.
I should say to listeners,
he's working on those issues.
Baichung Bhutia is a celebrated soccer player in India who participated in India's version of Dancing with the Stars. And is basically a pop star athlete and also a leader in organizing men's football in India with the establishment of its first players union, which is a really big deal. And he's a terrific and interesting guy. So I'm glad that you brought him up. All right. So I look forward to speaking with you again about not just the World Cup, but also your passion for AC Milan and and for football in general. Thank you so much for joining us on The People's Game.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Hey, yeah. Oh, no. Yeah, la, la, yeah. I'm Jennifer Doyle with The People's Game, and we have on the phone representatives of Global Girl Media, young women working in Soweto reporting on not only the World Cup, but issues that matter to them and to women of their community. Our first global girl on the phone today is Kamogelo. And Kamogelo, welcome to The People's Game.
Thank you.
I want to just ask you to speak a little bit about one of the stories that you produced for Global Girl Media, which listeners can tune into by going to your website, globalgirlmedia.org. I think I saw a story there about cell phones and daily life
yes.
in South Africa. Could you tell me a little bit about the story you made about this?
Yes, we had a story about cell phones. The main aim was to make awareness about the divisions that the cell phones are causing and different impacts that it has on different people in South Africa. And then we realized that cell phones are very important because of nobody wants to live without their phone.
No, it's true. Everywhere. So could you say,
how
have cell phones actually changed people's lives in South Africa in ways that you would say are unique to South Africa?
Okay, there are different perspectives. You find that we are friends, there are four of us, and then like we are sitting, and then everybody has their cell phone. There's this internet chatting site called Mixit.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody, you find that four friends are sitting together, but they're not talking to each other. Like verbally, they're using their cell phones via Mixit to talk to each other. So in a way, it is causing divisions.
Oh, so is that something that is that people are perhaps worried about, or older people worried about younger people using cell phones and this creating a kind of gap in communication, or is this a generational
yes.
issue? Yes.
Yeah, and the other thing about Mixit is that when texting, they use a different language. So even if they are talking to each other, adults wouldn't know what they have written because of they use, like, quotes.
This would actually, I think, probably connect you guys quite closely with the girls from Global Girl Media in Los Angeles. I know that this is very much an issue. Certainly, I'm speaking as a 42-year-old woman with a niece who's a teenager. You do definitely feel like there's this a language difference articulated through cell phones. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the World Cup and as an individual living in Soweto, how has the World Cup's presence in South Africa impacted you and your friends and in your daily lives?
It is truly an honor for us as South Africans to have this World Cup with us. But there are so many aspects that are many contradictions around the World Cup.
Yeah.
Whereas they said that the World Cup, when it is coming to South Africa, is going to help improve the economy and will also help other people develop themselves. But then there are some other issues around it that, like, there are street vendors and other people, business people, they are not benefiting because of sometimes at the fan parks, you will find that only Coca-Cola or McDonald's, which are the sponsors of the World Cup, are the ones who are supposed to sell, whereas the other people from outside can do that.
What about viewing games? Like, how are you and your friends watching games? Are you watching them in public with people or in more private settings? Have you been able to go to any matches?
Yes, as Global Girls, we went to one match with Brazil. There were Brazil and Chile played, the recent one, on Monday. And it was really fun.
I want to ask you a couple questions so I can give my listeners a sense of who you and your friends are. How old are you?
I'm 17.
You're 17. I want to say that for those listeners who get a chance to look at the stories are really nicely produced. And the Global Girls in Soweto speak with a very nice maturity about very important and very powerful issues, as well as small things that are making big impacts in daily lives, like for example, cell phones in terms of as a platform for developing whole new languages amongst teenagers. So, Kamogelo, are you planning on being a journalist? Is this something that your work in Global Girl Media opening up this idea of a kind of career path for you?
Yes, and Global Girl Media came as an opportunity for me to do so. It has helped me a lot, and I'm learning. Journalism is a very broad career, and then it is so interesting in the way that you get to say your voice out. And then you get to say what you want to say and make people aware around you and what is going around in their surroundings.
Kamogelo, could you tell me what team you're rooting for in South Africa?
Okay, I think Ghana. I'll have to go.
Ghana. You have to go for Ghana. Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
I have to.
Thank you. Hi, this is Jennifer Doyle with The People's Game, and I have on the line Anna. Anna, welcome to the People's Game. And I was wondering if you could talk to us about some of the stories you have recently produced for Global Girl.
I was with one about HIV, relating soca with HIV.
Yes. Oh, that's a really wonderful piece. So I understand that soccer is being used as a platform for educating youth in particular about HIV. That's what I was learning from watching a Global Girls piece. Could you tell us a little bit about making that piece and what you guys learned from that?
Okay. First of all, like, we were not exposed to this issues. So when we got to the Nike Center, that's when we got to have more information about HIV. And we also got tested, whereby I tested negative. Mm-hmm. So in a way, when they were talking to us, and like it felt like we've been ignorant about the issues around us, like HIV. So since they conveyed this to us and they explained all about like the HIV, it's not like a death end.
Yeah.
In a way, you can have HIV, but then you can live positively, eat healthy, and just live life.
Yeah.
As you were living it before.
I thought that was really interesting that a few of the Global Girls offered to be tested and then talked about their results, which were happily negative, on camera. That struck me as a very bold move on your part.
It was.
Yeah, were you guys nervous about going in for testing and doing that on camera?
Yeah, we were very nervous because we never thought we would come negative. It was a bit of both of negative or positive. Because I remember at school we had like this chick who went for an HIV test. She got tested like HIV positive, and she happened that she committed suicide after 2 days that she found the results. So we just thought that if, as Global Girls, we should stand up and be an example to people that if you can get tested, and whatever results that may come out, you need to accept.
Yeah, I thought that was a very activist decision on your part as young women to do that on camera. And so, if I understand correctly, this is a Nike-sponsored program whereby people are brought in to play football, and then woven throughout that is some health education and then also encouragement for testing. Is that right?
Yeah, it is correct. It's like they use soccer to especially like target young children, especially ladies, to be in the field, so that it's not only that they focus on soccer, but they also focus on the issues that affect especially girls, because we are more exposed to these issues rather than boys. Because boys, they kind of like, they're able to fade and like forget about some things that happened in their life. But for women, it's hard because we are multitasked. We face like a lot of issues like HIV. So that is why most of the time you get that girls are the ones who are affected and infected by HIV.
Yes. I'm here on the line with Anna from Global Girls Media, and we are talking about a project that they did, a story about the use of soccer by organizations, empowerment organizations, to educate and raise awareness about issues impacting South African youth, and indeed nearly every segment of the population, issues like, for example, HIV. And in this piece, the girls actually got themselves tested and talked about getting their results on camera. And that's part of a larger project in which young women in Soweto are producing segments, media segments, about the issues that impact their lives as a way, a different context for thinking about the World Cup in South Africa. So, Anna, I wanted to ask you, how old are you, and do you think you want to be a journalist? Is this something that Global Girls Media has encouraged you to imagine for yourself?
Okay, I'm 17 years old, and yes, I'm considering to be a journalist. But if it doesn't work out, I would like to be maybe an engineer, do mechanical engineering, because I'm studying science at school.
Oh, my goodness. And I've just have a question. Do you or any of the girls in Global Girls Media play soccer?
Yeah, there is two of them, I think, is Teboho and Nancy.
So
yeah, I think that's the two.
Anna, do you have a team that you're rooting for in the World Cup right now?
Yeah, I'm willing and hoping that Brazil wins, because they have this team, the best team. They can communicate. They have a strategy. Like, they communicate good. So I probably think it's going to take the World Cup.
I think that's a very good perspective and a great way to look at it. Is that who you want to win the World Cup, or is that who you think is going to win the World Cup?
I think it's going to win the World Cup.
Thank you, Anna, for talking with us about your work with Global Girl Media.
Hi, this is Manto.
Hi, Manto. This is Jennifer Doyle from The People's Game. Manto, so how did you come into contact with Global Girl Media?
I was part of the U.S. Embassy group. So they came. Amy came there and showed us a few things about camera, working with camera and all. And then I was so interested because I wanted to be a journalist, a broadcast journalist. So they said that we must write an essay. I decided to write that, and that's how I got in.
Oh, fantastic. So you have, being a journalist is something that you've long wanted to do. And you said, yes. Did you want to be a broadcast journalist, so where you're on television,
yes,
and on the radio? Is there a kind of journalism that was most interesting to you? You know, were you interested in sports, for example, or in news or international?
No.
Yeah?
Oh, I'm interested in hardcore journalism.
Hardcore journalism?
Yes.
Yes, so very strong and impactful stories that are very difficult to report. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Yes. So what story have you worked on for Global Girl Media?
Okay, we did a story on June 16, 1976, whereby,
yes,
we were commemorating the people who died for us and the people who gave us the freedom that we have today.
So can you tell your listeners a little bit more about the event you were commemorating for those who are not familiar with South African history?
Oh, okay. On June 16, 1976, people died because there was this apartheid thing. So now that those people died for us, we are commemorating that. So we have a holiday for that, whereby we commemorate that they died for us. They gave us the freedom that we have today. Now we can be able to speak to white people. We are not able to be wherever, like. In 1976, people were not able to go wherever they wanted.
Yeah.
They were not allowed to be journalists or something. The only job that black people could do was being a gardener or working in a house for someone.
And what's the date of this holiday?
It's June 16th.
June 16th, for listeners, it's really an international,
yes,
holiday commemorating the achievements of the young activists in South Africa,
yes,
who managed to change the world, really. So, Manto, are you following the World Cup? Like, what aspect of the World Cup's presence in South Africa interests you most as a young reporter?
Yeah, we're following the World Cup. We're so loving it. It brings joy in us. Like, for so many years, we haven't had that. So it's going to help us as South Africans, that it's going to bring up the economy. So, yeah, we're focusing more on the sports, the people, the players, and all.
And I want to thank you, Manto, for talking with us, and I want to encourage our listeners to check out the story that she worked on the commemoration of the uprising on the June 16th, 1976. It's a fantastic story. Manto, are you rooting for any particular team in the World Cup?
Yeah, that's Argentina.
Argentina.
Argentina, yeah. It's going to win. We're working as a team, and yeah, everything is perfect about that team. We have Messi there. So I think that team is going to win.
That team is going to win. Oh, great. Okay, so I love,
yeah,
it that we have three different perspectives on rooting for the World Cup. This is Jennifer Doyle.
Hi.
From The People's Game. And I'm on the phone with Zangile of Global Girl Media.
Yeah.
And I was hoping that you might be able to speak with us about the work that you have done around a very difficult subject of sexual identity and the experiences of black lesbians in your community.
Yeah, okay. And my team and I decided to do a story on homosexuality in lesbian people. Since most of the people are gay, and then they think they can judge them. So we wanted to show people that they don't have the right to judge them. They are also human. They have their power of choice. They have to choose what they want.
Was this a difficult story to produce? Many of the women that you were talking about have experienced sexual assault.
Yeah, my sister was also a lesbian.
Zangile, one of the segments was centered on the experiences of your sister and your family.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about doing such an incredible piece based on the personal experiences of your sister and your mother and yourself? Was that very difficult?
Yeah, it was so hard. It was so hard because she died, and then She was a fighter. She fought for women to be taken into serious consideration by our government. And she was proud of who she was.
Your sister was subjected to an assault, a homophobic assault, which took her life. She was an activist and a very outspoken member of her community, and I understand that she was inspired people around her. Could you tell listeners your sister's name?
Oh, her name was Busisiwe, which means the blessed one.
The blessed one.
Busisiwe, the blessed one.
Yes.
Busisiwe means the blessed one.
I was particularly moved by your mother's presence in the story and her openness in talking about how she reacted to your sister's coming out, and then she was very generous in sharing her grief with the viewers of the piece that you produced. Did your mother talk about what it was like to do this on camera, and what was it like for you as a member of the family to actually do reporting about this very personal issue?
Okay, we did that story to celebrate Bruce's life. Mm. We know that she would have wanted that to happen.
Yes.
We did that to commemorate her.
So it was a way to remember her and to share her story with others. I want to commend you on the piece. It's really fantastic, and it's a very important issue. I've been very moved by stories like that of your sister's life, and then also what happened to her. Can you tell me, Sangele, how old you are, and was being a journalist something that you thought about doing when you were little?
I'm 17 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love journalism because it gives a voice to those who don't have, and then I'll be able to speak out for other people.
You want to speak up for others and who may not be so empowered?
Yeah, and stand for what's right.
I'm with you on that. I want to, again, compliment you and your colleagues at Global Girl Media and the collective at Soweto. This is Jennifer Doyle with The People's Game. Can I ask you one kind of final question, which is to bring it back around to the World Cup and to ask you, as we've asked, we're taking a poll, who are you rooting for at this point in the World Cup?
Brazil.
Brazil. And why?
So because I can play, you know. They communicate very well on the ground.
They do. Another reason to root for Brazil is they have one of the most exciting women's teams in the world. So
I want them to win, and I know they will.
Great. Thank you so much, Zengele, Manto, Anna, and Komogelo, for speaking with us at the People's Game. And I want listeners to check onto their website, globalgirlmedia.org, and see the work of the young women in Soweto and also in East Los Angeles who are producing work, providing a different context for looking at the World Cup and the community that is impacted by this giant sort of media phenomenon. Thank you for speaking with us today.
Yeah.